Hello and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. As always, I'm your host, Pat, and I'm joined by co-host Bruno. Bruno, how we doing?
Absolutely fantastic, mate. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Ready to talk about the palace as always. And we have two guests today. Two guests, Bobby Manzi back with us. Bobby, glad to talk to you again. How we doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Very tired, but not bad at all.
No, I don't blame you, man. You only got a few more days left to this window. You can take some much needed relaxation time. And then we're also joined by Jude. Jude, how's it going?
Yeah, all good, thank you. Ready for this is my third episode now, so I'm excited to tuck into what happened over the weekend and what could happen over the rest of the week.
You've nearly done as many episodes as me.
Yeah, we got to keep it. We got to keep a counter on this, man. Well, unfortunately, the four of us combined have as many points on the table as Crystal Palace do in the 24-25 Premier League season. That's actually, now that we have no more August matches left, it is official. In the last four seasons, Palace have won two out of a possible 11 matches in the month of August. There could be some reasons for this, and we may get into in detail, but no matter how you slice it, we always seem to be playing from behind going into September with a slow start. So, Bruno, I'll start with you. Give me your kind of broad thoughts on the match. What did you think? What were your takeaways here?
Well, I don't think West Ham were particularly better than us. I think they showed a lot more quality in their chances. I think we, as a system, actually looked really quite good. I had no complaints with some of the build-up at times, especially in the first half. The way we were hitting them on the counter-attack and pressing them was excellent. It just comes down to chances. You know, Edouard had a great chance that he completely fucked up, to put it bluntly. Different player in behind, we'll get onto that. Tucks that away, we're 1-0 up. You know, Eze hits the intersection point with the crossbar on the post with a brilliant strike. Yet again, close. He's unbelievably unlucky. I don't think we were horrible. I just think we collapsed once we conceded, which is a consequence of having not taken our chances, which comes from the lack of quality in our squad, which is something that we should have addressed a month ago. So it's decisions. It's bad decisions sort of working against us, and it just makes our luck that much more against us. But all in all, it wasn't a, you know, depressing performance until that second half and until that collapse.
Yeah, and as you know, with me, I like to look at the objective things behind the scenes, and the data, the stats absolutely back that up. There's really nothing much to show for our defeat compared to last year. We're still attacking the same zones. Our field tilt was phenomenal. We had 75, close to 75% field tilt, which means that we are just keeping the ball in our attacking third for the entire, duration of the match, whether we have possession or not. We're keeping West Ham's possession in their defensive third, and we're keeping our possession in our attacking third. So we're doing everything Glasner wants us to do. We're not capitalizing. We had three big chances that I consider a big chance, anything 0.15 XG or over. So that's a 15% chance of going in when you look at a probability of it. And we had three of those in the first half alone. So to your point, they took their chances. We didn't. Particularly well for the first hour of the match when we had a substitution that really changed the match, in my opinion. So I'll slide it over to you, Bobby. We're talking about when Daichi Kamada came on and played in a deeper holding midfielder role in place of Jefferson Lerma. It seemed to kind of change the team dynamic a bit. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought it was a really frustrating substitution, personally. I don't think it made any sense. I didn't think Lerma was having a particularly good game in midfield anyway, but the moment you took him out of there, you just lost any defensive control. And it just made it easy for them to play through Palace's midfield. I thought for the, was it the second goal when Kamada was just well out of position? It left a huge chunk in midfield and West Ham were able to break easily because he dived into a tackle we should
First
never
goal,
dive.
first goal, first goal.
It
But
was the
yeah,
first goal.
absolutely.
First goal. Yeah, it's just, yeah. So first goal, it was shocking. I mean, it's just not a defensive midfielder. It made no sense bringing him on in there. Obviously, I assume the thought behind the decision was to try and go for the game at 0-0, bring a more attacking player on in there and, you know, try and be a bit more creative. But it just had the complete opposite effect.
Yeah, I did a whole kind of breakdown on that goal too, and that was the first in a just a domino effect of poor decisions and poor communication that led to that chance being taken at the end by Suchek. So Yeah, not great, not great to see, but hopefully things that we can fix as we have more time with each other, time to gel together. But let's not focus on the negatives from a loss. I know it's easy to do that when you come away with 0 points. Jude, I'll bring you in here. What's something positive you had from it? Something you could take away positive, whether it's a player, whether it's a style of play, or just anything you got going on there.
I think the same as what Bruno touched on at the start. I thought we set up perfectly okay. And similar to Brentford, I go to Palace with my cousin and my old man, and a best mate and his dad. And I said the same thing. We look really good, but if we don't take our chances, the Premier League is a very scary reality that if you don't take those chances, the other team is gonna counter you and likely take their chances, even if that's a relegation battling team. I'm not saying West Ham are, but I think we look structured, but we're still missing that. And I know we'll go on to talk about it later on. We're still missing an Elise-sized hole. But my standout again is Adam Wharton. He's just amazing. He will go on to no doubt be a transfer record, I think, in the maybe not in the whole Premier League, certainly an outgoing for us. And whoever does come in for him in the next summer, because I think we've got one more season with him. But I thought again, he looked he was stupidly composed. I don't get how he does it, but he was he was a positive from that game, I thought.
He was unplayable in the first half, but what I will touch on is how much I felt he dropped off in the second half, particularly after that substitution where Deitch Coman came on, because I think he lost a more physical presence next to him. It's not like he's not used to that. We had Will Hughes playing side by side with him last season during our best spell, but he looked well out of it. He struggled to win the ball back and was chasing, and Adam Wharton's much less effective in situations where the ball has gone past him rather than sitting in front of him. He's a pressing tackler more than he is a recovery tackler. And the
Yes.
second that West Ham started to use their pace to get past us and outnumber us because we'd committed too many people forward, because Kamada couldn't sit in that hole, because that's just not who he is. He's a drifter. And if you put a drifter in a midfield two, you end up with a midfield one.
And as well, if you partner Wharton with Doucouré or Lerma, they are recovery tackled midfielders, so you don't notice it as much. But the minute you just took him or took someone lot of that profile out of there, it was just easy for West Ham to play through midfield.
I completely agree with that. Really, without Hughes being available, Wharton took that Hughes role. And if you look at our two midfielders, what we kind of have under Glasner is we have one player who's more of a counter presser and more of a getting up into the attacking field if they lose possession, trying to disrupt it right away, win the ball back. And that's usually been Hughes when he plays because he doesn't offer much of a passing tree. He's not much of a holding screening guy. He's very good at being kind of a pest and disrupting. Wharton took that role against West Ham, and Lerma played that deeper role to Bobby's point, kind of screening the back three, back five, and allowing Wharton to get a little more forward. When you bring Kamada on, now you've got two guys that really just want to get forward and press. You saw that with that first goal where Kamada took the risk. Hey, I'm all for being aggressive. If you're going to make that aggressive of a tackle challenge on a dribbling player and Aaron Wan-Bissaka of all people too, which is crazy. You got to make sure that you either get the ball back or you foul him. And we didn't do either. And it just, like I said, set us up for a long chain of events that led to that goal.
And if you noticed as well, it might have been the first goal, it might have been the second, once again, can't remember now. But Mark was out of position for one of them too. So you'd actually lost the two midfielders and Mark was out of position. So we were isolated to what, four and three at the back.
Yeah, so the first one was the one with Kamada missing the tackle and Wan-Bissaka going down, cutting to Bowen, and then Wharton having to slide over to compensate for what you're talking about, leading to a chance by Paqueta, unlucky bounce clearance, failed clearance by Munoz, and Suchet goes and finishes. The second one was where, again, our wing backs seem to simultaneously be pushing too far up the pitch a little bit at times, a lot different than what it was last year. Mitchell and Munoz. I mentioned that Munoz actually was the deeper one on average this match, and just led to a ridiculous counterattack where there was nobody down the left flank, nobody slid over. That second goal was far too easy for Bowen, in my opinion.
Yeah, the thing is, Pat, I think that's a trend of the goals we're conceding this season because it's all the same kind of build up, which is us getting completely outnumbered on a counter attack. At Brentford, they killed us with that. The first goal, we had a Anderson too far forward and he didn't catch up and we just got caught on the break. Second goal, we just didn't have enough people in the box to deal with the mess. And there are multiple cases of similar chances, before the West Ham goal. And then they scored one on the break, and then they did it
Yeah,
again.
so
Like, we don't have numbers. And I think it is a symptom. And this is a trade-off that you get in a two midfield system, where if those midfielders aren't prepared to help out and cover out wide when the wing backs are too far forward, you're going to get in a lot of trouble when teams are running up
especially when
against
the
you.
centre backs
And I
go up as
think,
well, which is what we saw against Brentford with
yeah.
Anderson, and we saw it for the second West Ham goal with Mark Gay. So I've
Yeah.
just watched the goals back, and we were 3-on-3 at the back. It was Richards, Kamada, and Riyad against Wan-Bissaka, Bowen, and Soucek, or no, Fulcrick. So we were just totally outnumbered, and as you rightfully said, we just looked so vulnerable on the counter attack. And I think what has been the theme with Palace this season, I know we're only two games in, but they've been aerially weak and they've been defensively weaker. They've been quite a soft touch. When I ran the numbers after the game, I saw that Palace had only won 36% of their aerial duels, and they'd only made a 47% success rate of their tackles. I think it was really apparent in the games. We just looked a soft touch defensively.
That leans back to a couple of sort of strange tactical decisions from Glasner, which I've noticed at the start of the season, which is this preference to play with long balls, even though we're not winning those aerial duels, and we're sort of just hoofing it up and then losing it pretty swiftly. That's coming from Dean Henderson, and it was coming from Anderson in the first game. The way we're trying to account for missing a creator like Michael Olise, which is by overwhelming them with an overload of players, which is when we're getting those centre backs and wing backs up the pitch, so that we can overwhelm them and have more options and capitalize on when we do win the ball up high. Unfortunately, it makes us much more vulnerable. But if we had a player of Elise's quality or half of Elise's quality in that position, you don't need to gamble as much, because it's a risky gamble that we're only taking because we haven't got the players yet, because we need to resort to an overload and numbers rather
Yeah,
than skill.
that's a really good point. I've never looked at it through that lens of maybe we're pushing the wing backs a little higher because we don't have someone like Olise who's so threatening and so valuable in attack. Another thing that we were severely lacking was Joakim Andersen, of course, being gone to Fulham now officially. I looked this up. It was hard for me to believe. I know he's a great passer. I don't doubt that. He was actually the top player on Palace last season for progressive passes. No player on Palace last season had more progressive passes. That's a pass that goes at least 10 yards and or a pass that enters the box. So passes that are going to be threatening, move up the pitch. Nobody had more than Joakim Andersen for us. Now, somebody that I think might be able to replace him in that regard from the back line is our new signing from Real Betis via Barcelona. That's Chadi Riyad. And Jude, I'll bring you in on this. How did you think he did in his Premier League debut?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if we're talking about passing, I thought that was arguably his weakest point. There was a few at the start, but these are only short distance passes where it looked like he was maybe forcing it a bit too much. But there was other times where I can sense that he's going to be quite a key player for us eventually. He was beating the attacker. Whether that he, some of it looked a bit Mamadou Sakho-esque, where he looked a bit shaky taking the ball around him, but at the end of the day, he managed to get that little turn in and get past him. But I think it's definitely a work in progress. I mean, I'm not sure on the ins and outs of the board whether they wanted him to come in this season and start straight away. But I think if that is the case and he does end up doing so, I think he'll be more than okay. There was definitely flaws in his debut, but I think he was good enough and showed his potential for what he could do for the rest of the season.
Yeah, so I completely agree. I think for the first maybe 10, 15 minutes, maybe even 20 minutes or so, he looked understandably a little shaky. I mean, new situation, new environment, first play, first start in the league. And then he seemed to settle into the game a bit. In fact, no player for Palace other than Adam Morton had more progressive passes than Chadi Riyad's 7 that he had for the match. So he's shown the ability to pick a pass out. To your point there, Jude, it seemed that he was almost more comfortable playing a more progressive pass than the shorter ones, especially in the beginning of the match. I think he needs to work on some of his defensive positioning a little bit, and his communication with the players. But Bobby, I want to bring you in on this one because I do want to talk about the communication, the chemistry, the cohesion that we have amongst our players right now. It seems like just from watching the matches that there's not a big amount of communication. It seems like there's still a lot of guesswork between players knowing where each other are going to be,
covering for each other, whether it's a counterattack, whether it's a build-up play. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've had so many of our starters away for summer tournaments. And let's face it, these guys didn't get much time to practice together, to train together in these preseason. Eight of our starting 11 for both matches were gone for one of the three big summer tournaments. That's Copa America, that's Euros, that's the Olympics. Only Manchester City and only Liverpool have more starters than Crystal Palace do that were gone for these tournaments. So, Bobby, I'm asking you this. How do you think that's affected our planning, our ability to prepare for these first two matches?
Yeah, well, you had, like you said, eight players away for major tournaments, and you've had two players or two starters go out of the exit door. So, of course, it's not going to be cohesive. I mean, they look like they've not had a full preseason together, if I'm being brutally honest. And like I said in a tweet, which might have been a bit in the moment, but whatever, they look like they've not got a complete squad. And for me, I do think there's something to be said about getting your business done early. And I just think if you look at the way Palace are playing now, it screams that a team that just haven't spent a lot of time together. And there's other teams who have had, like Brentford, like West Ham, have had considerably less players away over the summer and have had a full cohesive pre-season, have got their business done, and now they're reaping the rewards of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that it 100% shows. It really does. I mean, we can crunch the data, we can look at all these numbers and talk about all these things, which obviously I have a lot of value for. I think they're important. But at the end of the day, communication is the most important thing. If we're not on the same page with our teammates, it's going to be a struggle. And I think that's a showing there.
And I think it's worth saying as well that the squad is unsettled because you've got, obviously, Ayew's gone, Anderson's gone, Elise's gone. But you've also got Mark being linked with moves away. You've got Jeff being linked with moves away. You've got Edouard being linked with moves away. You've got Mateta, who's ongoing with a contract dispute with the club. I mean, there's just no, it's not settled at all. And it's causing real problems in the performances on the pitch at the moment. Now, by Friday, it's probably all going to be fine. Palace will probably have four through the door and we'll all be celebrating what was a somewhat successful transfer window in an ideal world. But it just feels like they've wasted two games of the season. But obviously, external factors have affected that too.
Yeah, and we talked about in the intro that, you know, this isn't something new. There's been a lot of slow starts for Palace over the last few seasons. It's also something that our manager, Oliver Glasner, is known to have also as these slow starts. So kind of like a perfect storm right now in terms of not starting off on the right foot. Bruno, let me ask you this. Do you think there's a correlation between the poor starts and the seeming yearning to save our business until the last week or the last few days of the transfer window? Do you think those two things are connected?
It's a factor for sure. I think historically, an oxymoron, but recently, but on plenty of occasions, I think we've started seasons poorly, and that's not just due to the business that we haven't done. It's also due to the decisions we've made around the club. If we look at our preseason decisions and situations leading into the last three seasons, it's been poor. The tour to the United States is a strange one. The tour to Australia, where we were split, is another. It's been disjointed. There's been multiple occasions where we haven't been together as a club, whether it's international duty or literally dividing the squad in two and putting them on different sides of the world. If it's about business that we're talking about, I think it definitely plays a factor because we're missing three or four players. Two people on that bench yesterday, two players on that bench on Saturday have asked to leave, and Glasner's now spoken about that in his most recent press conference. This is an unsettled squad. We have players that will leave. We've got players that have left, and we've signed not even half of that number of players to replace them. I'm not saying we need to sign that number of players given the role of those players in the squad beforehand, but we were lacking depth last year. We're missing depth now, and we're missing starters now. And we've started a Premier League season without those players. That puts us at an instant disadvantage against teams who have spent well, like West Ham, or have a long going system with a same manager and the same general core of players in Brentford. They didn't have many new signings, if any, in that starting 11. It's unsettled, like Bobby said. And we've only got ourselves to blame because the strategy about leaving it late for the window, there are advantages in that, which I'm sure the club are aware of and are trying to capitalise on. But is it worth sacrificing 6 points? No. I think in an ideal world, there's enough faith in the squad amassed and the coach to not end up in this situation. But the reality is we're here and it's not the first time, as you've said. It's a historic trend of us poorly performing early in the season. So what I'll say is I hope to God we're looking to learn from this, because it's getting really boring that we as fans are predicting how our seasons are going to go more effectively, it feels, than those who are actually running the club. Because this happened last year with the decision to bring back Roy Hodgson. It happened with our business that summer. And to some people, it feels like it's been happening this summer with our business again. And it's a very frustrating position to be in, to think you know better than the people who are actually making the decisions.
It seems as though we've talked about how we want to find these young, quote unquote, safer options that will cost a little cheaper and we can develop into these big time players. I mean, that's the reason we got Elise in the first place, right? £7 million, flipped it to around 50. So do you think when it comes to replacing a player of his talent, of his quality, that that's a good strategy to have? Or do you think that maybe we should have tried to splash a little more money and got one of those bigger names, a proven name, to replace his goals, his creativity, and everything he does? Bobby, let's start with you on that one.
Sorry, what was the question?
Would you have rather done the strategy of replacing Michael Olise in a money ball approach where you're finding multiple guys to kind of fill the roles and fill the qualities that he had, a little bit safer in that regard? Or would you rather had the big proven name just come in, splash a little bit of the cash, maybe break our transfer record because you're replacing somebody of Olise's quality?
I think it's a difficult question, actually, because Crystal Palace Football Club haven't got £50 million to spend on an Olise replacement. And ultimately, that doesn't even go far enough to replace someone the quality of Michael Olise, because I think you were dealing with one of the hottest talents on the planet. So that's the issue. Now, I get why Palace have wanted to bring in three different players that kind of fill the void, if you like, in different ways, so you can be a bit more versatile with how you play, etc. But ultimately, I just think the squad lack attacking quality, and you kind of look at it and you think, where are the goals going to come from? And sometimes Palace's play in both games has been really good and they've just been unable to score and they've been punished for that. But it's because they've not got the quality up front to play that last pass or finish the ball. And in the last couple of days of the transfer window, I think while Eddie Nketiah is a great signing, I think if you don't bring in another number 10 who's fast, direct and can finish, I think Palace have big issues at the other end of the pitch. I really do.
Yeah, and to that point about chances and not taking them, you look at the actual goal difference, goals forced and goals allowed. We're at -3 right now, one goal to four goals conceded. So -3 overall there. But if you look at the underlying data, the expected goals versus expected goals conceded, it's only at -0.46, if I'm being exact. -0.5 if we want to round up. So it's very much a finer margin when you look at the actual chances we're creating rather than the chances we're taking or the chances that we're letting be conceded. I think that's another thing to the point of giving us a little optimism to turn this thing around and not to hit the panic button right now after two matches. But at the end of the day, it's about scoring goals and it's about not conceding goals. And right now we seem to be pushing too far up and being too aggressive and allowing ourselves to be countered easily. And we're not taking the chances we have. So Jude, how do you think we've done in the transfer window with Olise? Do you think that this three-pronged approach of replacing him is working, or would you have rather tried to get a 25, 30, 35 million pound player on the deck that maybe was a little more proven?
I think there's always been a plan in place. I think as soon as when Glasner was appointed, there would have been conversations had, look, we've got all of these players here, such as Eze, Gueye, Elise. Elise is the most likely one to go with his release clause, and without needless to say, as such, he's the most talented one there. How are you going to adapt to it almost? They went out and got Kamada, which would have obviously been at his request. I refuse to believe, based on our previous transfer model, that if Glasner wasn't in the question, that Dougie would be going out looking at Kamada and knowing that he was coming up on a free. Just don't see that's the type of business that Palace would notoriously do without someone like Glasner in charge. And then we need other options. As Bobby said, Elise is going to go on to be one of the best players in the world. I seriously don't have doubts about that. He's so, so special and one of the best players I've ever watched live. And yeah, it's easy to say, Palace fans want us to spend money. It's almost like a typical like FIFA career mode. You see all this money coming in, and you look at the base fee of how much we're getting. Oh, we've got to go and spend 75% of that fee on a replacement. Doesn't always work like that. And I think I won't touch on it that much, but just very briefly, it'll be the same when Gueye goes. They'll want another centre back to come in for like £40 million because Gueye's gone for 70 or however much he ends up going for. Just because we're spending a high amount of money, it doesn't mean we're getting the quality back. I think the approach Palace have taken to replace Elise is totally sensible. I think Saar was maybe a bit like with an ex-girlfriend as such. Dougie like just kept staying in contact and just couldn't really give it up, and then he ended up going and getting him. But if we get one more, then definitely I agree with it. But at the moment, I don't think, despite being two different styles of players, which I can see being quite sensible in Kamada and Saar, I don't think that's adequate enough to replace Elise. We need one more that is a totally different style of football as footballer, sorry, which is, yeah, as Bruno's also said, a bit more direct and just, yeah, hopefully can maximise our output, because that's clearly what we need going forward at the moment.
Yeah, and a bit more left-footed maybe too. Huh? We don't really have one of those. It seems that we're calling for one of those. And just briefly on Kamada, he's played 70 minutes in the role that I think he's going to play in the Premier League most often. Let him develop, let him gel. 70 minutes is not a lot of time. I think there's far too many people making sweeping generalizations, drawing conclusions after 70 minutes, and I don't think that's fair to him. If Glasner wanted him, and we really rate Glasner as a manager, I think we need to rate his ability to pick a player too and just give him a chance to gel and develop. But you do bring up an interesting point here, guys. And Bruno, I know you're going to have some thoughts on this. So I want to throw this one to you. Are we sticking with what we've assumed is our transfer strategy? Have we shied away from that model of finding some gems for maybe a little bit younger, high potential guys that haven't proven themselves quite yet and trust our ability to develop them? Do you think we're still doing that this window? And if so, why do you think we're not doing that anymore?
Well, we've certainly heard a lot in the press about, you know, Glasner coming in with a plan for post Elise and the club having, you know, thought about Glasner all the way since last summer. You know, there's a plan in place and these are the players we're going to buy. I'm not buying that our Elise replacement strategy was a long-term plan. I'm just not buying that. I think we have maligned our transfer strategy of younger players in those positions to sign players like Kamada and Saar out of opportunity and out of compromise, because Glasner has goals for Crystal Palace Football Club this season, and in that he will want Premier League starters who can compete for a place from the beginning and contribute, and he'll want players that know his system. And given how late we're leaving the rest of our business, we would have wanted to sign players who could come in and be immediately familiar with his style. And Saar, given the homework done on him, and Kamada, given their history, make sense from that perspective. However, in my view, I've been a Crystal Palace fan for a long time now, and my biggest source of pride after our great fans is our recent transfer strategy. That is the thing that I talk about two neutrals and they go, yeah, that's what I respect about Crystal Palace Football Club. Elise is amazing. Gehi's amazing. Eze's amazing. They respect that about Crystal Palace Football Club. And when we start signing players, like Kamada, fine, because it's free. Ismaila Sarr now really did baffle me at the time. And I kind of want to make the point that us signing Ismaila Sarr has actually put us in this really awkward position where we've now spent 12 million on a player who could arguably start for us and probably wants to, who can cover both sides and arguably the middle, but doesn't bring anything new other than the fact he can run fast. Look, he's a good player, and Dougie Friedman likes him, and Oliver Glasner likes him. However, what we lost when Elise was sold was someone who takes a man on, someone who can play a killer through ball or create a moment of magic with a pass, and someone who can create something out of nothing. Now, that last attribute we've got from Eze and is very difficult to replace. However, we have no one other than Eze who can take a player on right now with skill. That is scary. That is really scary, because an Eze that is chained up and doesn't have players that can bail him out and create space for him like Elise did is a very ineffective Eze. And whilst Kamada probably can do that with his movement, I don't think he can do it to the same extent. And by signing Sarr, I think we've now put ourselves in a position where we can only sign one player who has to meet too many different criteria that only Michael Olise himself or someone obscenely talented and out of reach like Johan Bakayoko could also meet the criteria of.
He was the one they should have thrown the boat at for me.
Yes, and if we'd sold Michael Olise last summer, we would have thrown the boat at Johan Bakayoko.
I think it's probably worth mentioning it as well, just to maybe manage expectations a little bit. Unless something major happens in the next, say, 36 hours, I don't see them bringing a 10 in between now and the end of the window.
And that, for me, is the problem with the Ismaila Sarr signing, is we've signed a player that's pigeonholed us into a position where we're trying to fit a player into boxes that there isn't a player for. We've got no one that actually does replace Michael Olise. And as I saw someone write for us the other day, the biggest issue with trying to replace Michael Olise with multiple players is you can only have one of them on the pitch at one time. So you're always losing a third of Michael Olise. If even that, you know, it could be worse. And I'm concerned that we've done a really inadequate job of replacing Michael Olise, and our strategy has been too heavily impacted by an idea of keeping Glasner happy by not spending, by buying players that are kind of done and that he knows. And I don't want to, you know, put words in anyone's mouth, but our strategy has felt half-baked, delayed, confused, and it's now put us in a position where we don't have a player we can sign, we don't have the money to buy that player, or are willing to spend it to buy that player, given the makeup of our squad.
Yeah, and with Sarr, you know, the idea is, of course, that maybe he was more of an IU replacement than trying to come up and be a starter. But when you really think about that and break that down, IU wasn't a player that was rated that highly by Glasner. We can talk about the 11 goal involvements he had in the Premier League last year, but 10 of them were under Hodgson. He had one assist under Oliver Glasner during that last part of the spring when we had that great run of form. So he wasn't really a player that Glasner selected very often.
Scored a goal against Burnley, though, didn't he?
Did he score a goal against Burnley? Maybe he did.
He did in the first game.
We got one goal, one assist. Still, I think the point still stands, right? He had quite a bit of success under Hodgson because, you know, Hodgson trusted. He understood who he was. He got the player. And he actually had another assist against Burnley. So one goal, two assists. So 8 of his 11 goal involvements for Jordan Ayew were not under Oliver Glasner in this system. So bringing Sarr in to replace that, what is he actually replacing? And I think that's a really good point with that. And it does seem to take away from bringing in a player that might be a little more well-suited to fit that role. And it is a little bit baffling. I mean, to Jude's point, is it just a case of Dougie being stubborn and just wanting to get his guy? Or is it a case of we really think this guy has a lot of value and maybe he'll show it? You know, we have 36 matches left in the league, so there's a strong chance that he can turn it around and show us some things we haven't seen. And I hope he does, because at this point, he's our player. I'm going to do nothing but support him and hope for the best.
Well, Pat, if I'm just going to jump in on one thing. which is that I have a lot of respect for Dougie Freeman.
I do too. I do too.
I personally choose to believe that he's not spent, you know, what would be around £40 million this window on two players based off, you know, naivety to the sunk cost fallacy. I don't believe that our director of football has spent so much time talking to Saar and talking to Nketiah to just overspend on them and get them in so he can say he got them in and make it worth it. I don't think that's the case. I think there are players in there that do add something to our team. You know, Ismaila Saar has that pace and quite strong finishing ability. And Nketiah is actually a very adept number nine and a versatile one as well. That is, you know, a Dougie Freeman striker that can do a fantastic, fantastic job at Palace. And that's why we're willing to spend that kind of money on him. However, I think we've changed our strategy significantly from building a Crystal Palace squad to building an Oliver Glasner squad. And that's been something spoken about in regards to Oliver Glasner in the past. The level of influence that he wishes to have over transfer business, it's led to him falling out with director of football in the past, and it's led to him losing jobs in the past. Steve Parrish's biggest redeeming quality for me is the fact that he and the people he's brought in present a unified long-term vision for the club, which is this sustainable model of buying younger players and selling them for more that we've done very effectively, in my opinion, especially recently over the last sort of 3-4 years. However, the biggest challenge of that is selling them for a good fee and replacing them and strengthening post that sale. And in my mind, all we've done is gotten weaker since selling any of those players. So that would imply that the director of football, the man buying them, I know he's meant to have provision over both aspects, but let's get serious about how our club is run. It's not Dougie Freeman that oversees departures.
It's not Dougie Freeman who oversees incomings either.
That's a complicated discussion that is too in-depth for this podcast. But my general point is he identifies the players and we've done a great job when we've bought them. I don't think we buy enough of those young players, and I think it's the transfers we don't do that pain me. And so far, we've not bought players and we've sold them. There's quite an obvious debt here.
I actually think that Palace have shown in the last, since the Vieira rebuild, that they're not a very good selling club. Because you have to look at who they sold, and it was nobody. And now all of a sudden they're selling everyone in one go. And it just doesn't make any sense at all. They did really well with initial investment, but since they've sold, they don't know what to do. I mean, they've got a list of names that they try and execute, but they're not doing very well at executing them. They've left it to the final week of the window. We're 4 days away now. When you're listening to it, we'll probably be 3 days away from the closure of the window. And things still look slightly unclear. I think bringing Nketiah in is good business to £30 million. But there's still clear gaps in the squad, and it's a race against the clock to do it. I think if Palace don't get four quality bodies through the door, that's the most important thing, and they were to lose Mark Gee, then I think it's just a statement to say we're going to stand still again. And that's ultimately not what they sold on Oliver Glasner in the interview, just 6 months ago?
Because we have the manager and we have a player like Adam Wharton and we have a player like Eberechi Eze, and we lose all three end of the season if we don't end up meeting our goals. I just think that's the most likely outcome. I think we need to be...
I think the biggest issue, and I think that's the one you have to hammer home on, is just leaving the business so late, and now you're looking at going into the final week of the window, potentially losing Mark Gahey as well after losing three starters already. That's the issue.
Just a week after the chairman himself said, I can't see a situation where we lose both centre-backs.
He regretted that the moment that came out of his mouth, because he literally stuttered as he said centre-back.
He is a marketing and advertising guy who knows how to say things that people like. He is the Joe Biden of Crystal Palace, and then he says things that sound good in the moment and then regrets it afterwards. Or he says something he thinks is going to, you know, get a moment of applause, get something, build morale. 6 months later down the line, he doesn't have the wallet or whatever else to back it up. And, you know, I respect it. This is something that happens when you've got a fan in charge, is that you've got someone who lets emotion play some role in the running of a football club. And I respect it. You know, I don't think football, which is a game, not a business, in my opinion, it should be a game first and foremost. Having emotion play a role in that is fine, and I encourage it, and I love that we're owned by a fan. However, if you're saying things like that and then directly contradicting yourself within a week, and the state of affairs are how they are now, is that not, you know, to put it mildly, really fucking concerning? Jude, I want you to sort of help me calm down here if I'm sort of playing it out of proportion, but it looks like there's not a coherent vision once you take into account the way we've abandoned the transfer strategy, the way we've abandoned the goals for the window that were said in a press conference a week ago, and the way that we're talking now about our goals for the season having completely changed from, you know, the optimism we had 2 weeks ago to this dismay that we're all feeling now.
Yeah, it's a really tough one to comment on when no one, unless you're very well connected, knows the ins and outs of a club. I was going to jump in about something separate that would have linked in 2 points of about Saar putting us in a bit of an awkward situation, similarly about Palace being not being a good selling club as such. Is the vision is still trying to prove to these academy players that we've got. I mean, as me and Bruno have spoke about a lot, we can talk about Jesse Derry all night, and maybe we should be doing things a bit differently there. But you've got a player that we're talking about Saar maybe causing us a bit of awkwardness to try to sign someone. We've got a player in Jezrin Rucksacki that has just gone on loan to Sheffield United despite two different clubs putting in permanent bids for him, which shows to me that the club want him to succeed at Palace. Otherwise, they would have cashed in on him. If we're trying to recoup as much money as we can through anyone, we would have sold him. And that's why I think we haven't gone all out for a replacement, because what's the point in spending so much money on an attacking right winger or right attacking midfielder, however you want to say it, if Rucksacki's going to come in next season after having a blinder with Sheffield United?
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Again, this is a stereotype. The majority of our fans, they get annoyed with him. They say, we don't spend any money. We're a bit tight with this. We're a bit tight with that. If we base it off of that stereotype, I've got no doubt that, as a presumption, of course, he could have well turned around to, or be thinking anyway, not say it out loud, but be thinking, you know what? We've got a world-class manager here. I don't need to reinvest most of this money because he can make do with the squad that he's got. And I'm not saying that's the truth at all, but there may have been this shift in vision now that we've got such a quality manager in, that he might be trying to do things a tad differently because he knows Glasner can maybe work with less than what Roy worked with. And that can, of course, potentially backfire. But I still think...
Yeah, I actually do slightly disagree with Jude, because personally for me in football, I find that the better quality the manager, the better quality of players they require to actually do well.
Because yeah, backer guy too, backer guy, I agree.
Because of the intricacies of their system, etc., they have to learn. So I thought we could do well on no budget with Hodgson because he could get the best out of a poor group of players. But I'm not necessarily sure that Glasner's capable of doing that. I think you need to provide him with quality players if you really want to kick on.
Yeah, and Jude, you do offer an excellent point, though, in that I do think it's true that, in general, fans, supporters, they kind of lack seeing the big picture, seeing the forest through the trees, if you will, that long-term thing. So maybe they don't want to block a guy like Jezrin Rucksacki next year or the year after down the road with a young incoming signing, and they do want to have just kind of a stopgap guy. I think that's a very good point there. But I will say, to play devil's advocate there, the longer you hold it to the end of the window, the less faith that you're going to have from the supporters that you actually have a plan. So I do think you both are making some good points there. But without any further ado onto that, I think we all agree that we want to get some more guys in. One of the most important players coming in right now, the big rumor that's coming in, is Eddie Nketiah from Arsenal. So Bobby, do you have any updates on what's going on with that?
Yeah, it's close. Big money deal, £30 million or £25 million plus £5 million add-ons. And I know everyone's been a bit negative tonight, and I get it, but I do think it's really good business. I think he's a quality striker. I think it's someone we've been after for a long time. He's obviously maturing now, if you like. He's what is he, 25? And I think we're almost going to get him at the perfect time in his career. He's a good striker, just not good enough for Arsenal. I think he will score goals at Palace as long as we create the chances, which is why we need to get another number 10 in. I mean, ultimately, could Palace change system? Could they go for a 3-4-1-2 with Mateta and Nketiah up front, and then maybe play Eze behind him? I think that might be one we could see.
If we're considering changing the system that saw us get so much success last season because we weren't able to adequately replace the one player we knew we had to adequately replace a year before he even left, I just think that's embarrassing.
No, but I don't. It might be more to accommodate the two quality strikers you've got. It just gives you options, yeah, and that's all I'm saying. So.
I wouldn't want to see us go to that model just because I don't think Eze can be that creator without someone alongside him to help him out.
Just from a point of that, Nketiah bringing him in gives you options. You're getting a quality striker who can score goals, who's decent on the ball. And I think it's good business. I think it is really good business from Palace. But they need to get more in, and that's the important thing. Getting Nketiah is not enough.
It wouldn't throw the system too far into disarray. It would be very similar. You'd really just have to adjust a couple things in that three-pronged attack up top at the basic back seven, plus the keeper would be very, very similar. So it wouldn't be like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It would just be a couple tweaks to the system, if that makes you feel any better, Bruno. But let me ask, let's say this does happen and we do bring Nketiah in. Is that enough? Did we provide Glasner with enough quality this window to do what he wants to do with this club?
I think they need to get Lacroix over the line. They're not far away from the valuation. I think the next bid will do it whenever that bid comes. I mean, I expect them to return with a second bid. Obviously, if they lose Mark, then there's a problem there. Reports tonight suggest that Joe Gomez could be a potential replacement. Now, that's not something I understand at the moment, but we'll see how that one plays out. Odion Cossonu, however, I understand him to be a favoured replacement for Mark Gahey, should he go. So I do think that provides quality to the back four, but I think it would be shocking to get rid of both your centre backs in the final week of the window. Looking at other targets, I mean, like I said earlier, Palace in an ideal world would get a number 10. However, they might just run out of time for that. They need a left wing back as well. Obviously, Gosens is one they've looked at. Will they go back or not is unclear at the moment. You would hope they would, but who knows? And then you've got an exit for Sam Johnson on the card. You've got an exit for Nairo Ahamada on the card. Now, Johnson will obviously be a permanent deal. Ahamada, it's a bit unclear at the moment whether it would be a permanent or a loan. And that's just another one we're going to have to see how it pans out. It's going to be a busy 4 days, no matter what happens. It could be a frustrating 4 days, or it could be a 4 days to celebrate. And we're just going to have to see how it pans out because things are changing by the minute at the moment.
Yeah, I think one thing that I really hope that we go for is, if it's not Gosens, some type of left wing back, some kind of help for Tyrick Mitchell. I think we've been really lucky with his durability. I think we are playing with fire a little bit in that aspect, because if he goes down, I have no idea who's playing down that left side. And yes, he's been durable, but the old sports scientist in me thinks through these things a little differently. Let's just take, if you will, a typical Roy Hodgson side, and imagine the amount of distance covered by a left back there. Now we look at Oliver Glasner's side and how his left wing back is kind of provided to shuttle up and down the pitch to provide some attacking options, which is going to fatigue you, which you're going to cover a lot more ground. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I would not be surprised if Mitchell is covering nearly double as much ground as he was under Hodgson. Just that increase in work rate, just that increase in distance covered, that's putting a lot of mechanical stress on the body, which in turn is going to add to more fatigue, which in turn is going to lead to an injury risk increasing, right? Not to mention we have these cup runs coming up. I just think that we're really playing a dangerous game not having a backup with him. And I don't think we've replaced Patrick Van Aanholt as a left back. We haven't brought in a left back since we brought him in back in the Sam Allardyce days. So that's somebody I really hope we bring in. Obviously, I hope we bring in the center backs and get somebody to replace Anderson. hopefully somebody that can play on that right side. We've talked about a little bit how I think that's a weak spot for us, and we can use some help there to let Munoz get forward. But all in all, I'm hoping that we can get some people in to fill up because we need the depth. This system is going to be physically imposing. It's going to be demanding. I think we really need the depth to help that out. Before we leave, I want to touch base on the cup match against Norwich. Bruno, what do you got on that? Do you think we're going to see a strong 11? Do you think there's going to be some rotation? What are you thinking?
I don't think we have the players to rotate. And we certainly don't have the time to register any of the people that we've been rumored to be close to signing in the last 24 hours. So it'll probably be something relatively similar to what we saw at the weekend with perhaps, you know, maybe an Ismaïla Sarr start is what I'd expect. I think
Remy Matthews in goal.
I think that could be a horrific event if so. We probably see Chaddy Riyad start again, but I'm not certain. I would love to see some
upholding a centre back.
Good lord. I would love to see some minutes for youth players off the bench. I think the most likely candidates there would be Franco Ume or Rashawn Mathurin at the moment. Personally, I'm a huge fan of Mofi Gemini and Ashraq Benoni in our academy. However, I think they're less likely to play. There's an academy game on Friday, which I think could play a role in whether or not they feature. But yeah, I mean, it'll probably be quite a strong lineup.
Shake Decore start?
Would love it. Shake Decore next to Will Hughes is probably what we're looking at the moment.
Yep, potentially. I just want to see Rob Holding play football. I mean, what? Palace have sold barely any tickets. There's thousands of tickets still available when I looked earlier on. Just give me Rob Holding at central centre-half and I'll love it.
Yeah, we signed for a reason. We haven't seen much of him.
We've only seen him once, which was in the cup match, right, against Man United, and then he got injured.
And he was awful.
Yeah. But you know, in a back three, with two centre-halves next to him, if he plays central centre-half, he might be all right.
Yeah, it could be.
Go on, the boy. That's all I want to see. I mean, I've gone mental now. I've been awake for far too long hearing about nonsense Crystal Palace. But just give me Rob Holding to start. I'll be more than happy.
All right. And as we're winding down the time here, we're going to call it there and wish you all a farewell. So from the four of us here, I'm going to sign off. Bobby, thanks for joining us again. And please get some rest when it comes to September 1st. You need it.
I'm going to get some rest tonight. I'm just going to turn the phone off and not wake up to the phone tomorrow morning. And hopefully the whole world would have sorted itself out by then.
And Jude, becoming a regular, thanks for coming on again. Our first show together, so I appreciate you coming on. Thanks for your insight. I really appreciated some of your views, man. I really did.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to meet you, albeit remotely. And similar to Bobby's praise of Rob Holding, I'm going to throw some praise back for Steve Parrish. Trust him. We're all going to be laughing by Friday at midnight. We're going to make some good signings, and he knows what's best.
It doesn't cost anything to be optimistic, so I'm going to choose to be positive with it. I like the way you're thinking, Jude.
I'd like to be negative because then you can't be disappointed.
There you go. That's how you do it. And Bruno, thank you as always, being the co-host, holding things down, offering that contrarian perspective at times, but I think you offered things here. So we appreciate what you're doing, brother.
I've been an absolute menace on this podcast, and I apologize to the listeners, but sometimes you need to be the devil's advocate with a lot more passion than you originally intended because you realize just how tiring it all can be sometimes.
And that's going to be all from us from the Palace Way pod. Remember to follow our socials. Check out thepalaceway.com for articles. And as always, up the Palace.